bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't.
Jose,
I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, powered by FanDuel Sportsbook. NFL Week 1, Monday Night Football Edition. 30 teams have already played. We have our first data points for the season. We'll get to all of those in a matter of moments. I'm your host, Todd Furman, joined as always by my esteemed colleague and co-host. But before I introduce him, I want to remind you guys, now is the perfect time to go to FanDuelSportsbook.com/bettheboard. Sign up for your $1,000 risk-free bet. If that first wager happens to lose, FanDuel will reimburse you $1,000 in site credit within hours to get you right back into the game. To all those folks in Arizona, hopefully you enjoyed your first foray into legalized sports betting. Encourage folks that haven't signed up with FanDuel, go check that out. Plenty of great incentives to get you into the mix immediately. And Payne, how'd the first weekend go for you, my friend? I know it's a little bit of sensory overload when it comes to trying to digest everything you've seen all at once.
Should have fired more. That was my biggest takeaway. Didn't fire enough. Should have just went drunken sailor mode.
It's always interesting because, I mean, we talked about it last week. These numbers have been up on the board for 6 months, and you try and figure out, you know, have you overanalyzed? Have you done all the homework? We know the digging has been taken care of, but sometimes you can almost talk yourself out of positions because you know so much about these teams. You feel, how come the market isn't responding with the same way we have these things power rated?
Right. That's the interesting element, and it's the first week of the season, and it's a long year, and it just, there's some games where, you know, Denver was one of the games that, I'll be candid, we were going to move on probably 4 or 5 weeks ago. And, you know, the Golladay news came down, the Saquon stuff came down, he wasn't looking very good. A couple other injuries for the Giants. And we said, let's hold off. And then it finally got to like 2.7 with juice, and I said, my gut is that Saquon's going to get announced up here. Let's have that hit the screen first and then attack. And it just went to 3. And at that point, I said, I can't lay 3 in this game. And so that was one of the one regret that I had this weekend that I could have capitalized on, but did not. Just the matchup was terrible for the Giants. I know there was some money that came in at +3 game day, but I just, you know, all the information was the other way. And so I just didn't fire enough. That was my biggest regret.
Well, if you're going to go down regret street there, the one game that stood out to me, and I know we discussed it at great lengths, we thought it was going to be pretty straightforward, was not backing the Houston Texans. As short home underdogs there, David Culley, an entire offseason to get a game plan together. We'd seen signs of what Jacksonville may or may not be, especially early on with a rookie head coach and a rookie starting quarterback. And I think we texted as soon as the Texans went up 7-0, and I believe the note said, here we go again. Sure enough, the Texans absolutely boat race and obliterate the Jags. You've seen their power number adjusted down as a result, but a hat tip to the Texans going out there and winning rather convincingly in David Culley's debut.
Yeah, another one that's kind of frustrating just because guys you respect are the reason that game got back to 3.5, and it wasn't just a full game position, it was a first half position as well, so quite strong in that ultimately takes you off the game. There's no reason to have battles, especially week one. Listen, David Culley, I thought, was interesting coming into the season. He kind of became billboard material for a lot of the analytics guys when he couldn't even pronounce the word. But, you know, you have a team that wins by 16 as a 3.5-point dog. So you're doing some things right. It was a game that, you know, was built up for a while because they have the lowest win total of the entire league, right? And the team was talking about tanking, or at least people outside the organization were talking about tanking, and they're trading players. They get rid of Roby. I mean, all of the things that we heard that, you know, this team's just playing for the future. And so this team's actually full of veterans, and they've been hearing that for months. And that was the biggest thing to me. It was a bunch of like proud vets out there going against young kids in an opening game. And Tyrod was very good.
Well, he was full on T-Mobile yesterday.
Yes, but he was willing to push the ball down the field. That was one of the biggest things I saw when I was looking at some metrics this morning. It was like 9.5 intended air yards per pass. I'm like, I wasn't Tyrod Taylor. Someone must have slipped into his uniform. But that was fantastic from him. Fifth highest intended air yards in week one. Two touchdown passes, which for those, that was a, you know, you and I talked, I think, Saturday night maybe about going over his touchdown prop of 1.5 that paid 2-1. Didn't ultimately do that again. Just didn't fire enough. But we knew Jacksonville's defense was going to be a problem. And then Urban's offense was, again, extremely vanilla. The only success they had in the preseason this year was going against the Saints in their second and third team starters in that game. Trevor Lawrence was horrific. Completion percentage 13% below expectation. Worst week one QB of the entire week, right? Other than Zach Wilson, trailed by a few percent. Something we actually talked about, right? Heading into this week was young rookie quarterbacks making their first start on the road in hostile environments with fans in the stands for the first time in, you know, a year plus.
Hey, it's one of those things that everything we think we know going into week one can change on a dime. Some of the constants hold true, and of course, there are other things that really adjust your perceptions. So there's no doubt plenty of buyer's remorse, I think, when you look at the way week one played out. But as you've reminded me countless times, Payne, this is a game there'll be plenty of opportunities for us going forward, and sometimes it pays to exercise discretion can be the better part of valor. But no doubt in the rear view for week one, a little bit frustrating. And for those folks new to the Bet the Board podcast, our Monday Night Football edition typically recaps what we saw over the weekend to get you looking ahead. So there'll be some look-ahead line discussion. There'll, of course, be an in-depth preview of the Raiders playing host to the Baltimore Ravens later this evening. But before we get there, Payne, we always like to start with the good, the bad, and the ugly. And because we are both the model of positivity on Monday mornings, I want to start with things that stood out to you in a positive manner.
I think the one game that we did manage to get on was the Cardinals. And as I'm watching this game, I'll be candid. I'm saying to myself, here we go again. The most penalized team from 2020 has four penalties inside the Titans 30 on the opening drive and have to settle for three. And then the next possession, Arizona's defense gets turnover, ball at the 1 yard line, false start. So on the first 12 plays, Arizona's got five penalties. And I'm just thinking to myself, we're not doing this again. This is not how the season's starting out. Fortunately, like, Kyler completes a ball to Hopkins in the back of the end zone on third down. The ball, when we were looking at player tracking data, apparently there's only a 24% chance of that ball to be completed. Sloppy early on, but Kyler was damn good. Accurate. Completion percentage 4.5% above expectation. When he played within the offense and didn't improvise, he was actually much better. 78% completion rate on quick passes for three touchdowns and a 7.8 EPA. So Kyler was very good when he was playing within the confines of the offense. And that touchdown to Christian Kirk, thought it was going to cause a storm. The thing was thrown so high, it must have touched a cloud.
I mean, that there's a reason that Kyler had potential to be a Major League Baseball outfielder. I mean, that throw would have been perfect on a dime coming from center field at Odetco Coliseum or whatever it's called where the A's play. But credit to Christian Kirk, too. He didn't even bobble it. Just kind of picked his head up, looked, it was like you were dropping the ball into a bucket. I mean, truly a thing of beauty to watch.
Yeah. They were fantastic, both sides of the ball, too. I mean, Chandler Jones gives the organization the old middle finger, the old F you pay me with the five sacks and a forced fumble.
Hopefully two forced they fumbles.
That dispute out. Yes, it's right, too. Yes. But, I mean, it was a combination of Kyler and the offense, and then obviously Chandler Jones just being an absolute force, and that's how you win by 25 as a three-point dog.
You know, pretty incredible start for Arizona. We've seen it before from Cliff Kingsbury's first two seasons. This team starts out like a house on fire. Teams make adjustments, and they struggle down the stretch. We'll see if 2021 can be a little bit different for the Birds. For me, Payne, I'll go all the way back to Thursday night, and I want to give Dak Prescott a ton of credit. A lot of question marks about his status coming into the game. We saw that number get back from 6 into the stratosphere, 8.5, 9. I think there were even some 9.5s out there at shops catering to recreational bettors. Dak banished all notions of that, saying, you know what, I'm out here, I'm healthy. 42 of 58, 400-plus yards, and reminded us why he commanded such a hefty price tag. But in that game, I also want to give his offensive coordinator, Kellen Moore, a ton of credit. I know Ezekiel Elliott fantasy football owners won't be thrilled to hear this, but Dallas came up with the perfect offensive game plan. Rather than running your head into a brick wall, trying to establish the ground game to set up the pass against that Tampa defensive front, they threw the ball, you know, nearly 75% of the time. It paid dividends. Of course, they weren't able to win the game because their defense is an absolute sieve, but this Cowboys offense looks to be as exciting as it was the first five games of last year.
You're spot on. And it was great seeing Dak healthy and looking his old self. He did a really good job getting the ball out quickly against Tampa's front seven. 2.4 seconds release time. Ended the game with a completion percentage 6% above expectation. And you hit this perfectly. The Cowboys coaching staff had a clue. The one thing we said breaking down the game last Thursday, you have to attack Tampa Bay secondary. You have to come out with this pass-first approach and use your strength, which is your receivers, and attack the slot with Lamb against Bunting, and that was the case before Bunting went down with an elbow injury. All of those things happened, so kudos to Kellen Moore. But I will say this, still some endgame mismanagement, and I know you're on the road against Tom Brady, as you alluded to, an 8.5, 9, 9.5 point dog. You're expected to lose, but +3 in turnover differential. And these weren't just your like garden variety turnover. These weren't turnovers at midfield, right? They were turnovers in prime position. Dallas recovered a fumble and started at the Tampa 27 one drive. They had a pick and started at the Tampa 21. Tampa's going in to make it a two-score game late, and Godwin fumbles at the one. Those are all high-value turnovers based on where they came at on the field. So no doubt, great seeing Dak healthy. Awesome knowing he's capable of throwing it 58 times and that Kellen Moore can come up with the correct game plan. But it was still a game that feels like it got away a little bit when you're +3 in turnovers.
Which has pretty much been the Dallas MO. I mean, close, but no cigar when it comes to being able to close out games when you step up in class. And eventually, if you're going to take that leap into that upper level tier of the National Football League, that end game variance, while we say there is obviously a level of randomness to it, you have to be able to execute, do the little things to get you across the finish line. What else, Payne, from watching 15 games so far this weekend really stood out to you?
I thought the Sunday night game. Matthew Stafford. I mean, it's always a difficult balance, I think, for guys like us, because as bettors, sometimes we want to be contrarian and we want to fade the noise and the hype. And it makes sense because price can be out of whack sometimes. But I always think two things can be true. And specific to the Rams and Stafford, they can be overvalued, even though they did cover the number last night and that side was both sharp and square. But I've said anytime we talk about the Rams, Stafford's ability is a perfect match with McVay's offense. McVay wanted a quarterback that could push the ball downfield. Stafford last night, 9.1 intended air yards. He managed a completion percentage nearly 10% above expectation. He was also fantastic in play action, which is a staple of McVay's offense. Stafford was a perfect 8-for-8 for 155 yards, 2 touchdowns, and a total EPA of 14.3 on play action throws. So it's possible that we start to see value fading the Rams against the spread, but that doesn't mean the Rams can't win these games, you know, straight up, because McVay and Stafford at this point are just like two peas in a pod. That is a perfect fit. And I think when you have an organization go out and spend like that, you have to be like 100% sure if you're McVay that that's your guy, that that's the guy you can envision execute everything within your offense. And so far, it's not like Chicago's defense is a sieve, right? They're a defense that is certainly should be above average, although I think we questioned the secondary a little bit and that you needed to attack them, and that was the perfect game plan. But this wasn't like some just sieve of a defense.
No, not at all. And when you look at the Rams, I think what was interesting in the telecast, Al Michaels and Chris Collinsworth repeatedly talked about the relationship that Sean McVay had with Jared Goff, where he had to kind of, I'm going to paraphrase here, drag him along a little bit and serve as a mentor to coach him up. Whereas once they brought in Matthew Stafford, McVay has been pretty open about saying, like you mentioned, kindred spirits, the two of them finish each other's sentences, and they see each other more as peers than anything else, knowing how young Sean McVay is. And if that's the case, when things are going well, the relationship is always going to be outstanding, you wonder how those two will handle their first bit of adversity if they happen to struggle to see the game the exact same way.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it, but I think that relationship is solid. They do see the game pretty much the same way. You even saw that touchdown pass to Woods to end the game, basically, and McVay's the first guy out there. He's like on the field. He's chest bumping. He's tapping helmets. That wasn't something we typically saw last year. So that bond seems to be much stronger. Now, to McVay's credit, he went the PC route and said, the reason a guy like Stafford is willing to come here is because Goff built this thing up and proved that it could work. So he's handled that situation, I think, quite well.
Hey, I mean, the reality of it is, if McVay was this quarterback whisperer, which we believe him to be in less need, they're still the organization that if they had doubts in Jared Goff, probably shouldn't have cut him a check for more than $100 million, but you want to see everybody get paid, and Jared Goff has found a landing spot, albeit not one that's soft, in Detroit, where I'm sure he'll figure things out. Payne, two quarterbacks that I wanted to highlight real quick, since we touched on the Texans at the top, I did have David Culley written down. You love to see a guy who's been a football lifer get that first win, and we'll see if they're able to handle prosperity. But wanted to mention Teddy Bridgewater. We know that was a hotly contested battle in Denver. Bridgewater goes out there and takes the job. He puts forth the fourth highest completion percentage in the first half in Denver Broncos history, which now has him mentioned amongst the greats there in Peyton Manning and John Elway. And of course, your beloved Florida State Seminoles, maybe the only bright spot for Florida State over the weekend. Jameis Winston, 5 touchdown passes in his New Orleans Saints starting debut.
You have to like what Teddy Bridgewater brought to that game. I mean, it's all about getting the ball out on time, playing within the offense, and getting the ball accurately to his receivers. And that's what he did in spades. 14% above expectation, his completion percentage. And the one thing that was great to see was not a ton of dink and dunking, 8.4 intended air yards per pass. So he was efficient. Sad, though, to see one of his weapons, Jerry Jeudy, go down. Although I think when we saw it live unfold, I was like, oh, he's out for the season. They're saying the MRI came back. It's just a high ankle sprain. Now, those can take multiple weeks, right? Probably even maybe a month. But it was better than the alternative of missing the season. Jameis Winston, obviously a big game for New Orleans. They wanted that. For that area. And so I thought he was fantastic in that game. Pushed the ball downfield. It gives you a little bit different of a look compared to what Drew Brees was. Completion percentage, 5% above expectation. So I thought he managed that game quite well. Got some help from Alvin Kamara. Didn't make the costly mistakes. And the one time that he did, the Zebras bailed him out a little bit with a roughing the passer. So I thought both quarterbacks were fantastic this weekend.
Anything else you wanted to touch on before we change gears and go from sweet to sour?
No, I think we've done enough ass-kissing at this point. Let's get into the dirty
stuff. All right, let's try and bring teams down from their high horses. I'm going to give you first honors here out of this T-box.
I thought it was Arthur Smith, right? Scoreboard wasn't pretty, obviously. I do want to dig into a little bit more of that game in a little bit here. But on the surface, what I watched was Arthur Smith struggled to be a head coach. And that is a big transition going from a guy who just calls plays. And once the play is done, like, you know, let the head coach handle the rest. But poor decision-making in a lot of areas. Extremely defensive, old-school minded in both play calling and decision-making. I mean, they're down at 22-6 at one point, and they're like punting around midfield. It was just very weird. You could tell it was his first game as a head coach. And so Matt Ryan struggled. Completion percentage, 9% below expectation. That's really tough to do when you have the third lowest intended air yards of the week. So you can't not push the ball downfield and be inaccurate at the same time. It's just a terrible combination. We knew there were some problem areas of this team, and you're hoping that they could disguise or camouflage them a little bit. But the O-line was a question mark coming into the season. Then they lost a starter right before the game. Matt Ryan was pressured on 41% of his dropbacks. The O-line didn't create much room in the ground game. The defense was a big question mark coming into the season. We thought Dean Pees would improve them, but he does run a very difficult scheme. So if you look at some of the data that is surrounding Dean Pees and how his defenses do year one and early on in year one, they tend to struggle just a little bit, and that's kind of what we saw on the surface here. But do want to dig back into that game a little bit more in depth. After the show.
You know, I'm curious to get your takeaway because normally, you know, stats for teams that are chasing the kind of deficit the Falcons did for the better part of the entire afternoon at least have the ability to pad the stat sheet in the third and fourth quarters when they're just chucking it around. That didn't appear to be the case for Atlanta, so I'm not sure if that's a harbinger of things to come. And you mentioned Matt Ryan, some of his struggles. Finished with an 18 QBR, 21 of 35 for 164 yards. And then I think you're going to get a number of people who are going to dig into the stats and go, look, here's how Matt Ryan's performed his career with Julio Jones. Here's how Matt Ryan has performed in his career without Julio Jones. So we'll see what kind of week one to week two improvement Arthur Smith can make as a head coach. I'll go on the other side of the ball, Payne, and I'll be critical of a side that I actually bet yesterday in the Washington football team. Justin Herbert went out there and put on a clinic. Now, I know the Chargers' yard per play numbers won't blow anybody away, but the Chargers were outstanding moving the sticks, 14 of 19 on third down. You know, Keenan Allen and Mike Williams combined for 17 catches, 182 yards, and a score. And despite looking like it was a tight game throughout, a 20-16 scoreline, and people that bet Washington kind of defending the injury to Ryan Fitzpatrick, that should have been a two-touchdown victory for the Chargers. If they could execute in the red zone, and Ron Rivera, he's got to wear some of this. Washington with a chance to at least go for it on fourth down in the fourth quarter, elects to punt and pin the Chargers. Well, guess what? They never got the football back, and that was all she wrote in a 2016 loss.
We've always joked because I do like Ron Rivera as a coach, respect him. And then obviously when he was going through his situation, you really can't say much, but I have no idea how he got the nickname Riverboat Ron. Never understood it. Never got it. Still don't. But here's what I will say to this. Obviously Henneke comes into the game. That's not how Washington drew things up. Antonio Gibson fumbles inside the five. Not what you're expecting from your bell cow back who's looking to take the next step. But I do want to take this a couple places. And I think Joe Lombardi was good. Justin Herbert was fantastic. Six trips to the red zone. Five of them were goal-to-go situations. And you mentioned the 14 of 19 on third down. Fantastic. But to me, it isn't quite the positive when you're projecting ahead because 74% third down conversions is not sustainable. And then the overarching question here is, why are you in 19 third down situations?
That's what I was going to ask as the follow-up. Why are you not in second and one and second and two with a chance to move the sticks?
It tells me that you're not great on on early downs, which needs to get fixed. I do want to dig into that a little bit more. We typically download a bunch of data like overnight. And of course the program crapped out at about 4 a.m. and didn't finish. So I want to see what they look like at week one, baby. Week one.
Get those preseason jitters out.
I want to see what that looks like when I get a chance to look at that. I guess it did finish right before we started recording, but you know, you look at it overall, it's a good first road start for Justin Herbert with fans in the stands. Obviously he had some road starts last year, but the first one in front of a packed house, and you're a dog that wins outright. And the best part was like Lombardi and Staley came up with a really good game plan. And even though Staley's a defensive minded coach in a game that remained for the full 60 minutes in a neutral situation, Staley was like, cool, throw the ball 62% of the time. I don't give a shit what it looks like for my defense. Just go out and do the right thing. And so when you have that marriage of OC and head coach slash defensive mind, that's awesome to see. Now, in saying that, one thing that I think we were ahead of the curve on a little bit here was this Washington defense. They're damn good. That can't be argued. They tried plugging some holes in the offseason, going and getting like William Jackson, and you get Jahmin Davis in the first round. But Washington played a horrific schedule of offenses last year.
Yep.
Fourth easiest, right? You know, the quarterbacks they played, it was like Wentz and Hurts as a rookie and Daniel Jones twice and Nick Mullins and Goff and Bridgewater and Burrow. And you put it all together, Washington played quarterbacks with an average PFF passing grade of 27th during the regular season. They faced a bottom five schedule of passing offenses. And we said that that was going to change. They're right now projected to face like a fringe top 10 schedule of passing offenses. And they're also in a situation where the opposing offenses, six of them, are going to have more than a week to prepare for that defense. So I think it's a very good defense. But last year we were under the impression that this was like elite, one of the best defenses in the entire league. And I'm not quite ready to say that's the case.
Hey, I mean, you brought up some valid points, and I think that was one thing that stuck out to me. I didn't watch the game from start to finish with complete tunnel vision focus, but it didn't feel like Justin Herbert was operating from a congested pocket throughout, that when he needed to make the big throws, the throwing lanes were there. And to his credit, whether it was back shoulders or getting a variety of his receivers involved, he was able to do that. And like we said, move the sticks. But again, you don't want to be in third down 19 separate times, even if it means you can put together long time-consuming marches to get you down the field. But with the bad pain, there can be even worse than bad. There's the ugly bucket that we like to hit on, and man, were there plenty of candidates to put in there for what we saw week one.
I think the obvious, the low-hanging fruit is Aaron Rodgers and the Packers. They just absolutely no show. Now, give credit to New Orleans. They were, that was as well as you can play a regular season game. But you start to wonder, maybe it's the heat and humidity that got to the boys from Wisconsin. Last few trips to the state of Florida, not great. Not great. Okay, lost to Tampa 38-10 last year. Then you lose 38-3 in Jacksonville. You go back to like 19 and 18. The Packers didn't travel south in those years. But even back in 2017, trips that were like the most southern, Carolina and Atlanta, lost both those games. So maybe the heat is a little bit of a factor here to think about moving forward. What I will say is, and we kind of adjust this, right? Because I think we kind of came up with, you know, you have the basketball, college basketball of like the 25-5 rule. And then we're like, okay, in football, let's call it the 10-3-3 rule. But you got to change it, obviously, every time they add a damn game. So
we'll go with the 3-10-4 rule.
I was going to say 11-3-3 just for the sake of the sanity. And so when you kind of just look at this and, you know, you say, hey, teams are going to play maybe 11 games at their power rating throughout the course of the season. Then you're going to play three games where you just are out of your mind, and then three games where you just crap the bed and look nothing like yourself. And the hope is that Green Bay falls into that latter bucket and that this isn't something more there, right? That it's not Aaron Rodgers just kind of packing this thing in. You don't want to speculate. I do want to see a couple more data points. The hope is, if you're a Packers fan, again, that this is kind of falls in that bucket of one of the three games where you just play like crap and don't look like yourself, and it's not Aaron Rodgers just going through the motions.
Well, that's the biggest question. I think you're right to reserve judgment. I know a lot of people, and I took a shot or two, saying, oh, he looked like a quarterback that basically didn't focus on football all offseason. But you brought it up going into the 2020 season, where Aaron Rodgers had been pretty outspoken about spending the entire offseason going back and watching tape and film to try and correct his mechanics, said he had a laser focus on playing football, and that contributed to his MVP campaign last year. Let's see if he's able to replicate those same type of efforts, knowing he didn't probably pay the same attention to detail when you're hanging out with celebrities and having a good time on the beach in Hawaii. Not there's anything wrong with that, but just don't go out in the field expecting it all of a sudden to look the exact same way it did a season ago. Green Bay Payne was one team that looked bad in that division. One of their NFC North compatriots didn't look much better. And that would, of course, be the Minnesota Vikings, who took not one, not two, not three, and I'm not even going to count it all the way up, but 10 first half penalties for 90 plus yards, including four on their opening drive. I watched the Vikings side by side with the Arizona Cardinals, and I thought I was watching the exact same game. The difference being the Cardinals found a way to obviously distance themselves from the Titans. Minnesota found a way to shoot themselves in the foot over and over, even after it looked like they were going to be able to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat.
Yeah, I think you hit it perfectly, right? I mean, it's the NFL, man. Like, everyone is relatively good. We did see some sharp game day money come in on the Bengals plus three, and then it kind of transitioned back right before kick. You just can't go on the road and have 10 penalties in the first half and expect to win games. You can't have the best player on the team fumble away the game in overtime. Those things just can't happen. Kirk Cousins didn't really push the ball downfield, although he was pretty accurate. Cook didn't have, you know, the dominant game on the ground that we've grown accustomed to. It looked like the Bengals' defense was a little bit better, right? I mean, we know they spent in the offseason, especially on the defensive line. They got some guys back healthy in the secondary. But you just, it felt like this was more, I mean, give Joe Burrow credit, right? Pretty accurate, aside from planting one in Kendrick's chest that bobbled to Boyd somehow and led to a touchdown drive. But for the most part, he was better than we thought he was going to be in his first start back after the knee surgery. Chase looked much better than he did in the preseason, but this just felt like a game that the Vikings lost. They looked ill-prepared. You're starting to wonder if some of the things internally going on there are starting to show up on the football field. We'll see. But just not a very good start to the season for the Minnesota Vikings, both in the preseason, some of the injuries they've dealt with, and then some of the locker room issues that are currently going on there.
That is putting it mildly, and we know Coach Zimmer is one of the guys in the hot seat. We'll see if they can right the ship with a very difficult road test coming up this weekend in the desert. Last chance, wanted to see if you wanted to get anything off your chest before we kind of pivoted into a few look-ahead numbers to see how the market has overreacted, or I guess in some cases underreacted, to what we saw week one.
You know, I see your list, and I think it's probably a big game to discuss, and it's not one that I was able to watch with full intent, so I do want to go back and peek at that, but Pittsburgh-Buffalo, I saw the Bills go up 10-0, then I saw Josh Allen miss Emmanuel Sanders on like a wide-open 50-yard deep ball in the first half, and then all of a sudden I flip back, and the Steelers are leading, and I'm like, what's going on? I don't want to kind of get involved in this game right now. I just want to watch every single snap later on, but I dug through some of just the generic numbers, and it's tough to see how the Steelers won this game. I mean, less than 190 yards through the air, 45 rushing yards from running backs. Obviously, the blocked punt for a touchdown can change things. Big Ben, horrific. Fourth lowest intended air yards, and then managed a completion percentage 9% below expectation. So both inaccurate and non-threatening. Great win on the road as a 6.5-point dog. Take that every chance you can get. And if it requires some special teams and some overthrows from Josh Allen, awesome. But I just kind of want to go back and see how they managed to pull that off.
Yeah, I'm curious to get your take out when you have a chance to do that. I mean, the first half, Buffalo returns the opening kickoff, able to muster three. And that was the extent of the scoring that we had until Buffalo scored a touchdown on their final drive of the half to go into the breakup 10-0. And at that point in the game, the Steelers had accumulated a grand total of three first downs. And it wasn't like their offense was that much more dynamic in the second half. You're right. When you talk about them capitalizing on a few miscues, I'm very curious to get your take on a failed fourth down attempt for the Bills that I'm not quite sure what the play call was. And this isn't playing Monday morning quarterback. It looked ill-fated from conception. But I don't think there's reason for Buffalo fans to panic, despite the text message I received from my friends in Western New York who want that, you know, $150-some-odd million back that they paid Josh Allen after one game. And on the flip side, Steeler fans who think a win in Buffalo, while like you said, is great as a 6.5-point dog, doesn't mask some of the concerns we had about the Steelers going into the season. So we'll see where those teams go from here. Buffalo clearly,
I think all of us would be looking for a little of that Josh Allen money.
Yeah, oh, there's no doubt about it. I mean, if we could get our piece of the pie there, I mean, by all means, let me know how I sign up for some of that. But should be an interesting game to see what Buffalo brings to the table when they head down to your neck of the woods for a pivotal division game where they're slight road favorites against the Miami Dolphins. Perfect time to remind all of you to follow the podcast on Twitter at BetTheBoard. Follow Payne at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there. Also, Payne, we ran a small promotion, I guess we'll call it that, on Twitter over the weekend. Do you want to highlight some of the specifics for folks to win a free $1,000 just for signing up?
Yes, obviously, if you are not aware of this, and we certainly have far more listeners and subscribers on the audio version of the podcast, but Todd and I are doing a video pregame show on YouTube TV. We are going to give away $1,000, $200 to five different people. All you have to do is go to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/bettheboard, or just go to YouTube and search Bet the Board. Subscribe, you're automatically entered. The drawing will be on October 1st.
Two moves where we saw pretty seismic shifts, although not necessarily through key numbers in one case. I'll kind of hit on them both at the same time. Look-ahead number was Denver, a 2.5-point road favorite, as they'll head down to Jacksonville for their second consecutive road game. Lo and behold, Denver goes out there, takes care of business against the New York Giants. Jacksonville doesn't look like an NFL-caliber football team against the Houston Texans. And here we are, Teddy Bridgewater and company laying 6 on the highway, up 3.5 points through a number of key numbers.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously you're going to get overreactions to 1 week of results, and that's all ultimately the balancing act that we have to do as bettors in saying, hey, we don't want to overreact to 60 minutes of football, but we also understand that our largest power ratings adjustments will come earlier in the season. So that's the ultimate limbo that you will do here, but you have a Jacksonville offense that's been very vanilla, that struggled mightily both in the preseason and in week one. And if you're going to struggle week one against a Texans defense, it's going to be very difficult to go against a Vic Fangio unit that is highly sophisticated and going to throw things at you from all different angles, extremely complex. So you do wonder what that will look like for Trevor Lawrence. And in saying that, though, it's also difficult to just say, hey, can't wait to get out there and lay six and a half on the road with Teddy Bridgewater. Although I'm sure his friends and family will make the trip to Jacksonville with him being a Miami guy and all.
Teddy Bridgewater, the ATM machine during his NFL career on the road, a remarkable trend, 22-3 against the spread in 25 career road starts. That's better than both Lamar Jackson and Josh Allen, the two other active quarterbacks that have numbers that are pretty impressive when it comes to getting you to the window on the highway. Payne, the Tampa Bay Bucks, and I swear this isn't the pile on Arthur Smith show, but the Bucks look-ahead number was 8. At FanDuel Sportsbook, we now see the Bucks a 13-point home favorite with a couple extra days to prepare as they'll welcome in a divisional foe.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty much the gist of it. You have the Super Bowl champions who managed to win a game despite -3 in turnover differential, and you have an Atlanta team that just looked absolutely inept, still trying to find itself on offense. We knew the defense wasn't going to be very good. So if you have to keep up in a game like this, is Atlanta going to be able to do it? And I think ultimately that's the big question. We're even seeing some spots leak out to 13.5 here. So for me, want to poke around a little bit more on this one, but nothing for me at this point.
And last but not least, two teams that we highlighted, one that put together a pretty impressive week one effort and one that was rather disappointing. You see the betting market adjust accordingly. Arizona, look ahead number at FanDuel Sportsbook, had them listed as a 1.5-point favorite playing host to the Minnesota Vikings. That number has now ballooned out to Arizona, a 4.5-point favorite, depending on where you look.
Yep, got to 4.5. I don't know ultimately what is going to come of this, but we saw just a touch, just a grazing of Vikings money, you know, first thing Monday morning at 4.5. Certainly the ultimate contrarian play with how Minnesota looked. Maybe Zimmer gets his boys back on track. Patrick Peterson returning home. You had some ill comments towards him via text. Would you like to share those publicly?
I would. And hey, it's no knock on a guy who puts together a very fine podcast with one of my CBS colleagues and a guy who's one of the best cover corners in the National Football League during his time. But I'll tell you one thing, Payne. Foot speed, not quite there. And yesterday, I may or may not have described him as looking more like a traffic cone out there in that Minnesota Vikings defensive backfield.
Yep, you did. So I'm intrigued to see where that ultimately goes, but did see a little grazing of Minnesota early this morning at 4.5. Not sure ultimately where that one is going to end up, but that's the situation we have when you go on the road and lose as a favorite to the Bengals, and Arizona goes on the road and wins by 25 as a dog. You're going to get this market reaction, and it's obviously a huge move through the 3 and the 4.
These games are always interesting to me, and this is the last look-ahead number that I had in front of me, because you wonder what public perception is of the Vikings. If Dalvin Cook, who we both agree was down, I was stunned to see that call confirm that it was a fumble late in that contest. If Minnesota wins that game 27-24 instead of losing 27-24, what that does for the narrative, given how poorly they played to escape with a victory. But hey, look, you get 17 of these, you better go out there and perform if you didn't perform the prior week, and we'll see what we get from these two teams who had very disparate results in their season openers. Encourage all of you, our loyal listeners, FanDuel.com/bettheboard. Go ahead, sign up. Make sure you get your deposit cash in there. Take advantage of plenty of aggressive sign-up bonuses, rewards, bet boosts, you name it. FanDuel is the place where you want to be this fall. All rules and regulations do apply, so make sure you check and see what's applicable in the state where you call home. All right, Payne, Monday Night Football, right here in my backyard. No, I will not be in attendance for this game, as I'm not going to deal with the black hole and any of that level of craziness. But it is the Baltimore Ravens, or at least what remains of them, laying 4 points out here at Allegiant Stadium. Total on this game, 50.5 at FanDuel Sportsbook. And when you look at Baltimore, week one has been, well, let's call it what it is, a wrecking ball for the rest of the league. They've outscored their opponents 144-19 the last 3 years in their season openers. They've won their last three season openers by 30-plus points. 4 years ago, they won by 20-plus. Meanwhile, you look at the Raiders, and under John Gruden's leadership, this team's actually been very good, especially early in the season. We know what kind of offensive mind he brings to the table. But again, the biggest question for Baltimore, what will this team look like, especially on the offensive side, as they deal with a laundry list of injuries, but a Raiders team that the market hasn't shown a ton of respect for as far as their season win total is concerned?
You're spot on with everything you just said there. What is interesting to me is there is an underlying component to this game, and it's Gus Bradley. He is the guy that created the semi-successful blueprint to defending and slowing down Lamar Jackson and Baltimore's offense. And if you remember, he was the Chargers' defensive coordinator. And back in 2018, when the Ravens and Chargers played in the wild card round, Gus Bradley just whipped up one of the more unique defenses that I think we've seen. He rolled out what they called a quarters package. I don't think it was a traditional one, but they basically play with seven defensive backs on the field at times. And then Bradley would have guys clog the middle of the defense and just, you know, stand three guys up over the center. Okay. And effectively what that did was it forced Lamar or the running back outside where all the speed of the defense was, because you had a slew of defensive backs on the field. And in that game, the Ravens were held to 3.9 yards per play, a 31% success rate, and only two explosive runs all game. And with this being the first game of the season, and, you know, Gus, the Raiders basically having the ability to spend more time focusing on one opponent, it's something that you have to consider that might get broken out here again. And then you also have this factor of Marcus Mariota. I mean, he could probably be one of the most effective scout team quarterbacks that any team could have in preparing for Baltimore, right? Just mimicking him throughout the entire week. And then you also have Ngakoue, right, who saw Lamar in this Ravens offense virtually every single day at practice. You know some of their tendencies. Obviously, the verbiage is going to change. The language is going to change. But he knows what they really want to do. He knows what certain things mean when he looks at something, right? Different looks that they're going to provide. He's going to be able to shout that out. Now, let's also keep this fair. Lamar was a rookie in 2018, and he's a far better quarterback now than he was when Gus kind of broke this out as the Chargers DC. And the reports have been that Jackson's throwing the ball better than he ever has during camp. But my gut says, even with, like, you know, all the scheme stuff that I mentioned, it's going to come down to the Jimmys and Joes, right? Like, do the Raiders have enough horses in the secondary to mimic the style that the Chargers use with seven defensive backs? I'm not quite sure. But, I mean, it's not a good defense. Now, your hope is that it's improved a little bit. I mean, they allowed 53% of possessions last year to end in a score, most in the league. I don't know if the Raiders have the same caliber of player, but you do wonder if it helps, right, with all these injuries that you mentioned at the top for Baltimore's offense. And you start to, like, go down that list, and obviously we know J.K. Dobbins out and Gus Edwards out and Rashad Bateman out, who you spent a first-round pick on, who's going to change the offense. And you look, and it's like, you know, the top two receivers are Hollywood Brown and Sammy Watkins. Both guys last season have a defensive adjusted value below an average receiver. Okay, so I know everyone's, like, gets hyped about Hollywood Brown, but, like, every single snap that you factor, he was a below average receiver last year. Mark Andrews coming off a down season as well last year. So there's not a ton of weapons out there. So if Gus Bradley breaks this out and it's somewhat effective, it could change the entire game, Todd.
Yeah, I mean, you listed off some of those guys there, and you mentioned the receivers. I mean, Watkins and Hollywood both missed time in camp as well, so who even knows how healthy those two are. The other injury, I think, that's flown under the radar, not for us, but maybe for the casual fan, the Ravens go into this without their best blocking tight end as well, and Nick Boyle. So let's see how that potentially impacts the run game and what you're going to get from Tyson Williams, who will make his debut as a lead back. We're not quite sure how Latavius Murray or Devontae Freeman will get used, but clearly some concerns for this Baltimore attack. But when you look on the other side of the ball, Payne, I mean, Derek Carr seems to be maybe one of the most disrespected quarterbacks in the entire league. You can believe what you want with Raiders beat writers saying, oh, no, you know, John Gruden loves him. He's happy to have him here. You know, actions speak louder than words. And this guy has been shopped around more than maybe any quarterback over the last couple of seasons. And suddenly Baltimore goes into this with arguably one of their more impactful injuries, playing without Marcus Peters, asking a guy like Anthony Verrett to step into the role as the number two corner opposite Marlon Humphrey. John Gruden does one thing well, and that's design offenses and scheme things up. That's got to leave the Raiders a little bit more optimistic in terms of what they can do on that side of the ball.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And a couple things that immediately stood out to me as I started breaking this game down. It's the first thing is the Raiders have to protect Carr. And we know the movement of the O-line group this offseason. You know, you trade Trent Brown and they trade, you know, Rodney Hudson and Gabe Jackson. The best returning lineman you had was Richie Incognito. He's out tonight with a calf injury. So there is some questions up front. Derek Carr is interesting because he has not graded out well under pressure during his career. He has shown some improvement the last few seasons, but still some questions. Let's see if the Ravens can get some natural pressure, but that's also a question mark for them coming into the year. You know, they traded some guys away, didn't re-sign Judon. They're relying on, you know, a rookie pass rusher and Houston, who's past his prime at this point. So it's going to be interesting to gauge where the pressure comes from, because we know the Ravens love to blitz. Wink Martindale is one of the most aggressive defensive coordinators. He's led the league in blitz rate the last three seasons. But Carr has been absolute nails against the blitz. We know he's cerebral. He can, you know, change protections at the line of scrimmage. He can call for motion to see where the pressure's coming from. Carr has a passer rating above 120 when blitzed the last two seasons. So how Baltimore gets pressure will be interesting here. If they can get it naturally, Carr is shown to struggle. If they have to blitz, Carr has really picked the blitz alive the last few seasons. So that's something interesting to watch. Natural pressure versus manufactured pressure is going to play a role in this game. Second thing for me, all the teams that have great success against Baltimore's defense, they don't play scared, right? They don't let Baltimore bully them around. They attack the attacker. And that's part of Derek Carr's game, which I think we kind of hit on in our preview series, Todd. And that's really where Derek Carr surged last season. His average intended air yards were nearly 2 full yards deeper than the year prior. Completed air yards, 1.5 yards deeper than the year prior. Nobody had a higher adjusted completion rate than Carr on passes thrown at least 20 yards downfield last season. So, I mean, Carr was pushing the ball. He was attacking. He was uber efficient. Let's see if Henry Ruggs and Bryan Edwards and Renfro and Zay Jones are good enough horses to consistently allow Carr to attack downfield. Final thing that I believe is pretty important here, and it's a matchup that we'll have to monitor, the Jimmy Smith situation. I did not check in the last 30 minutes. I don't know if you have, Todd. He returned to practice on a limited role for the first time this past Wednesday. He had an ankle injury that was of the high ankle variety. I think it was the first week of August. I believe August 6th he suffered the injury, and he's been out ever since. The planned rumor this season is that Jimmy Smith's going to take on more of a role covering elite tight ends.
Yep.
Darren Waller obviously fits that bill. If Jimmy Smith doesn't play, then Wink Martindale has to scheme Waller out of this game, because I don't think there's a linebacker on this roster that has a prayer. You know, Malik Harrison, Patrick Queen, those are 2 second-year starting linebackers. They were horrific in coverage last year. We outlined Patrick Queen's woes in that area. I mean, he was lost in coverage pretty frequently. And then when he was able to actually locate an offensive tight end, basically, I mean, he was targeted 60 times. 85% of those targets turned into catches, allowed a 118 passer rating and 4 touchdowns. He graded out the worst cover linebacker in the NFL last season with at least 200 snaps. So those are the important things to look for. Obviously, for Baltimore, big game on deck, right, against their arch nemesis, the team that they can't quite figure out how to beat with Kansas City in the Sunday night primetime game. So you don't want to say look ahead for an opener. But certainly, I think when you look at the schedule, the cross-country trip might not be as important to some of those guys in the locker room as the national TV game against Kansas City. So it is interesting to see how this line is going to move tonight, because my mind says there's a little bit of a battle, right? I mean, you can play contrarian and you can fade all of the injury noise and the offseason turmoil that the Ravens have suffered because it is so public, right? But there is an element to this where there are a lot of sharp guys that I'm hearing kind of just treading water right now, and we may see them come out in full force here on the dog.
When you look at this game as well, one interesting addition to the injury report happened last night in terms of the Raiders. Does it change the handicap at all for you if Josh Jacobs can't go, knowing that they at least have a more than capable backup now in Kenyon Drake, given the fact they spent $11 million on him over a two-year deal?
I know that he has the toe injury, and he's been limited in some practice. I don't know if he'll get a full workload. I believe they signed Peyton Barber yep. as a precaution because of that. And so we'll ultimately see what happens. Is he fully out? I thought it was a game time decision.
Well, it was weird because last night he was added questionable and it had nothing to do with yeah. physical ailments. It was with an illness. So you always begin to speculate this day and age what it yep. may or may not be.
Yep. Gotcha. So that obviously would change some things. You know, he's an interesting back, right? I don't know truly how to value him because we saw when he first came out, he was impactful to this offense and he allowed them to do things that they didn't have the ability to do. And then last year, he just wasn't uber efficient. We saw guys like Booker come in that were making substantially less and be more efficient. And as you alluded to, they went out this offseason and signed Kenyon Drake. So if he's out, he definitely will be missed a little bit, but I don't think it's a death blow by any stretch when you have Drake.
Yeah, don't have him as a game-breaking back. We saw his productivity decline amid a variety of injuries. Now, don't give the Raiders too much credit for having the foresight to acquire a backup. This is a team known to draft guys in the top three rounds and cut them before they even play it down. But that's a different discussion for a different day in terms of how the Raiders scouting department elects to do business. All right, my friend, first Monday podcast of the season officially in the books. Wasn't sure if there was any other tidbit or nugget you'd like to add before we take a 48-hour break and reconvene on Wednesday with a little college football discussion and try and put our win streak on the line.
That's everything I have. That's it.
All right. For all of you, our loyal listeners, hopefully your first weekend of betting the National Football League was extremely profitable. We know the Browns gave you a little bit of sweat, but what fun would this business be if you get a box-to-wire winner there with a six-point dog who had to dodge a successful two-point conversion attempt in the waning moments of that contest. Best of luck with all of your investments for Monday Night Football between the Raiders and Ravens, and hopefully we'll see you at the window.
Thanks for listening to Bet the Board. You can catch Todd and Payne every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday during football season, breaking down the biggest NFL and college football games. And to make sure you don't miss any free best bets, subscribe to Bet the Board on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.